Welcome to Berlin Inside Out, the podcast that takes an expert look at how Germany sees the world and the world sees Germany, with me, Benjamin Tallis.
And me, Aaron Gash-Burnett.
Hello and welcome back to Berlin Inside Out, the foreign affairs podcast in association with the German Council on Foreign Relations that takes an expert look at how Germany sees the world and the world sees Germany. I'm Aaron Gash-Burnett, a journalist and security analyst specializing in German politics and foreign policy, and I'm here with my friend and co-host Benjamin Tallis, senior research fellow here at the Council and head of its action group, Zeitenwende. Now, Ben, regular Berlin Inside Out listeners will know how important we think it is to ensure that we're all first at least aware of the systemic competition that we're currently in between liberal democracies on one side, that includes Germany, and authoritarian regimes like Russia and China on the other. And that's because from that awareness, we can act strategically and proactively rather than reacting to an authoritarian set agenda from the back foot, which we unfortunately too often do. Now, that systemic struggle has military, economic, and soft power fronts, and having a plan for how to use all those resources and power that democratic states have is part of the grand strategy we've spoken about regularly on this podcast, including in detail a few episodes ago with Maximilian Terhalla, Eileen Matla, and Jakob Ross. But there is a technological dimension to these strategic questions too, isn't there?
Yes, there certainly is. And living in Germany, we're acutely aware of the need to master technological change, if not quite the reality of doing so at the moment. And our guest today, Chris Miller, has done anyone who works in geopolitics an enormous favor by making clear in the book Chip War the interlinkages between technology, geopolitics, geoeconomics, between the different parts of our societies, and how absolutely crucial the access to the technology, particularly semiconductors, that power our lives and our economies is. But moreover, to highlight the technological aspects of the race for power, the race for more advanced technology, that for the technology that keeps us safe and gives us a military edge. And this has a long history that Chris traces in wonderful detail through the Cold War and into the post-Cold War period, right up to the present day and the systemic competition with China and also with Russia that we are engaging in. And it's those intertwined histories of economics, politics, science, technology and military affairs that really fascinated me about this book, which I can't recommend highly enough. Rarely have I learned so much from a book I've enjoyed so much, I have to say. And so to all our readers out there who have yet to have the pleasure, you have a treat ahead of you. But it's not just me who thinks that. The book Chip War has been named Business Book of the Year by the Financial Times. The Economist called it one of their Book of the Years, as did Foreign Affairs. It's a New York Times bestseller. I could go on. The list of awards and accolades for Chris's work is long and distinguished. Chris Miller is professor, an economic historian at the Fletcher School, the Global Affairs Graduate School at Tufts University, as well as author of Chip War, as we mentioned, and several other books. Do look him up. Chris, it's a pleasure to see you again and to have you on Berlin Inside Out.
Thank you very much for the invitation to join you.
Thank you very much for joining us, Chris. Now, many of our listeners might be familiar with China's historical claim, which it's had since 1949, that Taiwan is a province of China, it has no right to be its own state, and that it doesn't rule out force to take Taiwan. Now, our listeners are also no strangers to the dangers of authoritarian states threatening democratic states motivated by imperial history. But your book brings up another particularly noteworthy reason why China might want to invade Taiwan. As you argue, chips are the new oil. This is a big central point that you make in the book. And Taiwanese chip manufacturers lead the world right now in terms of manufacturing know-how. So let's start by asking just how dominant is that Taiwanese know-how in terms of that manufacturing? And is that a reason why we might be underappreciating the risk of China trying to invade Taiwan potentially?
Well, it's definitely the case that Taiwan is the most important country when it comes to manufacturing chips. There's a Taiwanese company called TSMC, the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, which is the world's largest chip maker and also the world's most advanced chip maker in terms of its ability to produce processor chips. And advanced processor chips are in basically everything. They're in your phone, your computer, they're in the telecoms infrastructure, they're in the data centers that are increasingly important for training and deploying. artificial intelligence systems. And when it comes to the most advanced chips, 90% of them are made by TSMC in Taiwan. And when it comes to AI processors, almost 100% of them are made by TSMC in Taiwan. And that's true for AI processors that are used in Asia, used in Europe, used in the US, even used in China. And so that means that Taiwan is really at the center of the world's technology supply chains. Most people don't realize it, but for almost every aspect of their daily lives, they rely on TSMC chips whenever they touch a piece of technology. And so it really is hard to understate Taiwan's economic and technological importance to the entire world.
Right. What you bring out very clearly in the book is the salience of that particular node in what I think you rightly describe as the incredibly intricate, incredibly complex and efficient, yet incredibly vulnerable global supply chain that we've managed to build for our most crucial technologies. Could you talk us through a little bit how that came about and what its strengths and its weaknesses are?
Well, I think you're right to illustrate the importance of the supply chain, because Taiwan is the manufacturer of all of these critical chips, but they can't do it alone. And in fact, many of the chips that Taiwan manufactures are actually designed by companies outside of Taiwan. Apple, NVIDIA, AMD, Qualcomm. It's actually largely US firms that are designing chips and then sending those designs in Taiwan to get manufactured. But the manufacturing process itself that occurs in Taiwan depends on inputs from Europe, from Japan, and from the United States. So, for example, the ultra-precise tools that are used to make chips come from the Netherlands and Japan, as well as the US. The materials that are used in chip making also come from these countries. And so Taiwan is critically important, but on its own, it can't do anything without its relations with US and European and Japanese firms. And so thinking about the entire supply chain is critically important. The good news is that most of this advanced semiconductor supply chain actually does happen in the US, in Europe, or in Japan. The unfortunate news is that there's a surprising amount of concentration in Taiwan, and it's become more concentrated in Taiwan just as the risk that I think China poses to Taiwan has grown. And that's the core of the problem.
Right. And you say it's unfortunate, but of course, the Taiwanese, some Taiwanese politicians, some Taiwanese people talk about this as their Silicon Shield.
I think you're right to focus on the ways in which it is unfortunate. I don't think it's at all unfortunate that Taiwan has developed this critical industry. I think it's actually great for Taiwan, and in a lot of ways, great for the world. The problem is that our ability to defend Taiwan has been deteriorating at the very same time as we become more reliant on Taiwan for the chips that power our entire technological and industrial base. And so if we had the ability to deter China at the level at which we could 30 years ago, this wouldn't be a problem. This would be nothing but a success story for Taiwan and for the rest of us who have benefited from the ultra-precise, capable, and efficient chips that Taiwan can produce. The problem is that just as the geopolitical picture around Taiwan has darkened, as Western and U.S. deterrence capabilities have, I think, eroded, we've also become more reliant at the same time. And so it's really the combination of this this dependence plus, critically, the, I think, growing Chinese threat to Taiwan that makes this such a problematic issue.
So then does our thinking around geopolitics need to change then? Does our mindset need to change in order to have a blueprint for how we are to increase those deterrence capabilities again? So the quote again that we started the show with, chips are the new oil. Is East Asia now the new Middle East? And how does that concentration that you've talked about of the semiconductor industry, the geography of its know-how in manufacturing, redraw potential geopolitical hotspots? And how do our assumptions need to change about what the conflict of the future might be, were that ever to come to pass?
While Chris takes a moment to think that one through, I'd just like to direct all of our listeners' inquiries about that comparison to Aaron via Twitter. Thank you.
I think that is the right comparison to make. We've all spent the last half century learning about the challenges posed by advanced economies' reliance on Middle Eastern oil. And that's posed a whole set of geopolitical challenges, which have been very complex. And we've spent many decades debating how best to mitigate and balance these risks. if you look at the chip industry, it's even more concentrated than oil production. Saudi Arabia produces 10 or 15% of the world's oil, depending on the year. Taiwan produces 90% of the most advanced processors. So there's even more concentration here. And there's more concentration because the chip making process is harder than oil drilling. Lots of countries can drill for oil. There's some technological complexity, especially when it comes to fracking or horizontal drilling or deep offshore. But the level of complexity is substantially less than in chip making. And so I think that does mean that we've got to begin to realize that when we're thinking about security in East Asia, it's not just about security dynamics that matter. Certainly, Taiwan's security is important in its own right. And it has huge implications for the rest of the world order, but it also has huge economic implications too. And I think you can't understand potential crises that might emerge in East Asia without thinking about the economics alongside the security dynamics, just like you can't understand any Middle Eastern crisis without thinking about how every government is trying to reason through how oil price dynamics will shape other countries' reaction functions. The same thing is true for chips and electronic supply chains in East Asia.
Right. And just to give people a sense of this, of both the scale and the complexity involved, you mentioned before the lithography machines that are used for producing these high-end chips. And Europe obviously has one of the global champions of that industry, ASML, the Dutch conglomerate, which formed by basically buying up their entire supply chain in order to control production processes to the level that was needed in order to make their world-beating technology. And if you look at where they source from over the world, it's really a sort of hyper-globalization story that's been told. And it relies on that flat world of the 1990s, which then came to pass through corporate structuring in the 2000s and the 2010s. And this worked, and I think this is what your book brings out quite brilliantly as well. This worked because of the scale involved. If you think about the distances, the things involved have to travel. It sometimes blows the mind to think this is a more efficient or cost-effective way of doing things. But I think one anecdote from your book that really brings this home, which I'm going to just quote to readers, to understand how much is involved in each one of these chips. So you note that Apple sold 100 million iPhone 12s, each powered by this A14 processor chip, which has 11.8 billion transistors carved into its silicon. And I thought it was amazing the way you brought this out. You say, so in a matter of months, for just one of the dozen chips in an iPhone, TSMC in Taiwan fabricated over 1 quintillion transistors. And that's a number, as you say, with 18 zeros behind it. Now, to put that in context, last year, the chip industry produced more transistors than the combined quantity of all goods produced by all other companies in all other industries in all of human history. And that is the scale that makes this global efficiency work. And that's what we're dealing with. So unscrambling those eggs is going to be pretty tricky, isn't it, Chris?
That's right. And the goal, I think, is not to completely unscramble those eggs. We've got to keep the scale dynamics in place, which is why when I hear political leaders occasionally talk about self-sufficiency, I get very nervous because self-sufficiency is not even a realistic goal, but trying to achieve it, I think would have vast and unfortunate consequences in terms of creating inefficiencies that would slow technological progress and drive up costs. The challenge is that we of course can't keep, I don't think, technology supply chains structured in the way they are, both in terms of their entanglement with China and in terms of the points of concentration they have right outside of China. And so that is the balance that I think Western leaders are trying to strike right now, Japanese leaders, European leaders, US leaders, is to do enough restructuring of supply chains to gain more margin of security, but to not impose too great of cost on the industry that would have the effect of slowing technological progress. And so to me, that's why we've got to have as much coordination as possible between G7 countries and between close allies in making sure that we've got a shared space for supply chains to develop even further, to have this division of labor between countries. But we've also got limits when it comes to trade with countries that we can't trust. And that's the balance that I think we are trying to strike right now.
And that comes actually to something that we've discussed on Berlin Side Out several times, the national security premium, or indeed friendshoring. And when we talk about China, This word comes up a lot, the idea that we should trade more with our friends and also have supply chains that are more integrated with our friends. That, of course, brings up the question, you know, who is a friend? So, and where do you manufacture, for example? But the other example that comes to mind here, too, is ASML in the Netherlands. I mean, they were none too happy about the Dutch government restricting their sales into the Chinese market. And at first, they couldn't sell their most advanced lithography machines, and they couldn't even service machines that they had already sold in China. And then they accused the US of putting its finger on the scale. But how far apart are we really between, you know, the US and Europe, for example, in terms of how we actually see friendshoring when it comes to, you know, this industry in particular? Where do you think the lay of the land is?
Well, I think there's a debate within Europe, within the United States, and also within Japan, which is worth considering as well, between business and government as to what level of friendshoring makes sense. I think business naturally wants to focus on efficiency. Businesses naturally don't want to restructure supply chains unless they absolutely have to. And so the same debate that's happening between ASML and the Dutch government is happening between US chip firms and the US government and Japanese firms and the Japanese government. So that's understandable. It's good that businesses are making their voice heard to some extent. Governments need to consider their interests. But I think in all three of these regions, US, Japan, Europe, governments are much more concerned than they were a couple of years ago about becoming too reliant on China or areas that are exposed to China risk, partly because of the way China's changed in the last couple of years. Partly because the Russian invasion of Ukraine has made very real, I think, the reality that authoritarian governments can do very dangerous and seemingly risky things. And partly because I think the pandemic, although it wasn't related to geopolitical shocks, did illustrate the extent to which supply chains for all types of goods, not just advanced chips, have become so complex in ways that governments and even companies only barely understand. And so I think the governments have across the board been more willing to push towards friendshoring as a result. I think in Europe, there's differences between countries, of course. I think the Dutch are actually on one side of the spectrum in my experience and being more skeptical of deep economic interconnections with China, more concerned about China in a political sense. I think if you look at some Southern European countries and also Germany, you get a different view. I think Chancellor Scholz's visit to China not too long ago was a very different type of visit than you saw when the Dutch Prime Minister visited earlier this year. And so I think that does certainly stand out to me.
Indeed, a different approach is taken. And you begin the book talking actually about the chip choke and how the US in particular was able to put the squeeze on China to cut off their new oil. Could you tell us a bit more about that and what levers we actually have that we can pull?
The US has been trying to pursue technology restrictions in two different spheres. One is with regard to advanced AI chips, the types of chips that are used to train OpenAI systems or Anthropic systems, the most complex AI models. And today, these chips are produced largely by a couple of US firms and manufactured largely in Taiwan. And now, since 2022, they've been illegal to transfer to China, at least referring to the most advanced types of these chips. The second type of restriction that the US has been imposing alongside the Dutch government and alongside the Japanese government relates to chip making tools like the lithography tools that ASML produces. And the rationale here is that if China can buy the most advanced chip making tools, it can then make the most advanced chips itself and then use them for whatever purposes it likes. And so the US strategy ultimately is described as being about Chinese military capabilities. And that's true to an extent. It's certainly the case that China will use whatever AI chips it has for military as well as civilian capabilities. But I think to really understand the US strategy, it's about something deeper, which is which bloc is going to create the infrastructure on which the next generation of technology is built. The West has benefited from the fact that over the past half century, its companies have largely built this critical technology infrastructure, with one glaring exception, and that's Huawei in the telecom space. Now we're building a new generation of infrastructure for a world that will see AI be a primary driver of productivity increases. And so the question of, well, who builds this infrastructure is, I think, not just a technical question nor an economic question. It's fundamentally a political question. And I think the U.S. is focused on making sure that it's Western companies that are doing this. And it's worth underscoring, it's not just U.S. firms that are part of this infrastructure. It's the Taiwanese who actually make the chips. It's the Dutch that make the machines that make the chips. And so I think seeing this as a broader Western strategy is actually the accurate way to look at what the U.S. Has been trying to accomplish in pushing its companies and also its friends towards a more restrictive strategy.
Absolutely. And Chris, for how long do we have the edge in the current system? How far away is China from actually achieving silicon sovereignty?
I would say, first off, that the restrictions that are currently in place have already slowed China's progress. It's now been 6 years since Dutch regulations have prohibited Chinese firms from acquiring the most advanced lithography tools that are used to make the most advanced chips. And if China had been able to buy those tools 6 years ago, it would be in a much, much stronger position than it is today. Because it can't buy those tools, China's leading chip maker is around 5 years behind TSMC of Taiwan in terms of its ability to manufacture advanced chips. And I think the Western goal is to keep that gap in place. And 5 years might not sound like much, because the quality of chips doubles every 2 years. 5 years is 2.5 generations of differential, ballpark terms. And so the U.S. is trying, alongside the Dutch and the Japanese, to hold back China's progress. But I think it's equally important, probably more important, to focus on the fact that most Western governments are also doubling down on their efforts to spur technological progress. Because ultimately, you're not going to win if you only hold China back. More important than that even is racing more rapidly forward yourself. And that's what efforts like the EU Chips Act and the US Chips Act are partly intended to achieve.
This is in some ways nothing new. And I think that's something that the book brings out very well as well, is that technology gap that existed in the Cold War time. I mean, you very, very well illustrate how the Soviet strategy of copy it, steal the technology and copy it, actually condemned them to relative backwardness throughout the whole Cold War and kept them 5 years behind, roughly speaking, which, as you say, is a world away in terms of the tech that was there. But of course, also, that was a time when the US was trying to maximize its competitive advantage economically, as well as in the military race against the Soviets, as well as in that geopolitical competition. And it came together with questions of, again, who are our friends? Because, of course, Silicon Valley only really took off when they shifted production to Japan.
That's right. And it is, I think, important to note that the chip industry has been internationalized since essentially day one. The first chips were invented in 1958-59. The first offshore assembly facility was set up in Hong Kong in 1963. So from almost day one, there have been trans-Pacific ties that have been critical to the structure of the industry. And Europe's played a very big role from the earliest stage. And as we noted before, that's been key to technological progress, having this division of labor between different companies and different countries. And it's meant that we've always had to think about chip strategy in the context of other markets and other friends. And this worked out relatively straightforwardly until pretty recently, because there was commercial competition between U.S. firms and Japanese firms and German firms and Korean firms. But most of the technology leaders were in friendly countries. The difference now over the past couple of years is that Chinese firms have become real technology challengers, and they've become technology challengers at the exact same time as China's government has become a systemic challenger to Western leadership in the world and the Western dominated world order. And so you can't see this today simply as commercial competition. And I often hear people describe what's happening as a trade war, and that completely misunderstands the stakes. There's no strategic interest of the United States or of Europe in promoting this company or that company, except that these companies are critical in laying down the infrastructure on which the rest of economy and society depend. And so it's not just about corporate earnings in this quarter or that quarter. It's not about the trade deficit or the trade surplus. It's about who gets to write the rules of the next generation of technology. And I want that to be companies that are based in countries with similar sets of values and not in China.
Right. And You've mentioned just now sort of something that I almost see as the value of friendship between Western countries and technological leaders in those countries, this kind of exchange between the democratic world when it comes to this particular industry. And that seems to give us an edge in this particular case, at least so far. You have argued before that Chinese chip making is becoming, you know, more Soviet in a way, and that its own authoritarian politics, in contrast to cooperation, could actually hamper its ability to catch up to the know-how in democratic countries. And so what makes you say this? Does liberal democracy have an advantage here when it comes to staying ahead on chips?
We should differentiate somewhat between liberal democracies and market economies. I think market economies probably are the key driver of advantage rather than liberal democracy. But I think democracy does explain why property rights are more durable in the West than they have been in China. And if you look at one of the key challenges to China's tech sector over the last 5 years has been the politically driven crackdown on Chinese tech companies, whereby the fact that China doesn't have the rule of law has in fact undermined property rights, discouraged investment in China's own tech sector. And so there is a linkage between the democratic aspect and the actual effective functioning of a free market. I think, however, we shouldn't rest on that as the key source of our advantage. I think it's probably true that over the long run, if you had two equal systems in terms of capabilities, the liberal free market economy would win out over the statist economy without the rule of law. But I think we're in the midst of a really tough competition regardless. And that's even considering the fact that US plus Europe plus Japan GDP is substantially larger than China's. The reality is China's got very successful firms. It's got very impressive engineers. It's got extraordinary focus on this issue. And so pretending that we can do nothing because our system is better, I think is a recipe for failure. I think if you want to win the competition, you've got to compete.
Right. And indeed, again, this is a recurring debate that comes up through the book, is how to actually harness those different sources of our power, how to align them in ways that are advantageous to us rather than our enemies, to really make good on that promise that is there, that we can't just rest on our laurels, but we actually have to activate this advantage. I'd like to hear a bit more from you, Chris, about how that was done at various stages in the past, be that through Bill Perry's offset strategy and actually sort of giving a boost to the silicon industry there, or earlier in the very beginning of the semiconductor industry, how those different aspects of US society, be that education, science, technology, military, and then the market, came to actually give the US the advantage in the first place, the US and the West, I should say.
Well, I think I would start by looking at the question of who funds new innovations in this sector. We're used to, I think, in the software space, having big venture capital funds funding new companies that then go on to create apps or social media platforms. But in the semiconductor space and the broader tech hardware space, what you find is that governments are much more important in terms of putting up funds because the capital requirements are larger, the technology is more complex, there's a longer time from innovation to reaching a market. And so dating back all the way to the start of the chip industry, it was NASA, for example, the US Space Agency, or it was the Department of Defense that were funding the core technology development. And that was critical to making it possible to improve technology enough to the point where companies could pick it up and then introduce it to a broad civilian market. And I think to some extent over the past couple of decades, we have collectively in the West underinvested in this type of technological development, in part because a lot of the reason we were doing more of it was due to Cold War competition. It was Cold War competition that induced Western governments to put money in this sphere. And when geopolitical competition seemed to temporarily go away in the 90s and 2000s, so too some of the funding dried up. And I think that is starting to change, and we've got to make sure that persists because that funding is really critical for early stage technological development. I think the second thing is there's long been a sort of implicit assumption in Western circles that if we pursue free markets, everyone else must be pursuing them too. And so I often, for example, in the space of the chip industry, see concerns about Western governments starting a subsidy race by supporting chip investments over the past couple of years via the EU Chips Act and the US Chips Act. And of course, you would only think that the West was starting a subsidy race if you knew nothing about China's chip policies. And in fact, there's been a subsidy race ongoing for a long time. We've just only decided to compete in it in the last couple of years. And so there too, I think you've got to look very carefully at the roles governments are playing. Would it be great if we had a level playing field in the chip industry and China is playing by the same rules? That would be great. But that's not the world we live in. And so I think we've got to be realistic. If China is going to subsidize to an extraordinary degree, chip facilities will understandably move to high subsidy locations. And so that's the second sphere where government policy really does play an absolutely critical role.
And understanding the nature of that geopolitical challenge, as well as the playing field, as you put it, seems to be key. And being able to encapsulate that in a strategic thinking that can prioritize these kind of connections between those different sectors that really gave the advantage to the semiconductor industry in the West during the Cold War is our challenge renewed in different circumstances, it would seem. Now, I did mention this term offset, and that's been a consistent theme of using technology to offset other disadvantages or the advantages of others. And in the 1970s, that was the feeling that the need in the West to offset the growing nuclear forces of the Soviet Union, but also their superior conventional capabilities. They could outmatch or overmatch NATO's conventional capabilities. We heard the term offset again used in the Obama administration. Was that actually successful in offsetting the advantages that others were building, or do we need a new offset again now?
Well, I think we're actually still in the process of developing the offset that was set off in the late Obama administration. I think it's certainly true that Western defense establishments, partly because of the perceived lack of geopolitical competition, partly because of their focus on counterterrorism in the 2000s, have not been thinking hard enough until recently about the ways that new types of technology will change warfare. I think that has changed dramatically, especially given the shock of the Russia-Ukraine war. But in order to succeed in updating the way Western militaries fight to next-generation technological capabilities, we need sustained investments and sustained focus over a long period of time. And I think on the investment side, we're starting to see this happening in Europe and the US. In terms of focus, I think one of the key challenges is that it's one thing to spend more money. It's another thing to convince the bureaucracy to do things in different ways. And militaries are very big bureaucracies. And it takes a lot of sustained political focus to get them to shift their priorities. And that's where I think you need very senior political leadership that are making sure that militaries aren't taking their new resources and buying old systems, but rather taking their new resources and buying new systems that will be useful in new ways. And we see this to some extent, but I think there's a lot of work to be done. And it's particularly important that I think we're very careful in any limitations we impose on the use of new technologies. Western publics are understandably nervous when they hear about space as a new domain for military competition or semi-autonomous systems being deployed in the military sphere. But the reality is, these are the places where new technologies are going to be most impactful, and our adversaries are going to not be constrained by any moral considerations that we might be by. And so we must be careful, but we also, I think, must not be overly constrained and prevent our militaries from developing the capabilities that they ultimately need to defend us.
This is an interesting point. The British architectural theorist Jonathan Meads once said that necessity may be the mother of invention, but war is its birth mother. And actually understanding where this is going at the moment in Ukraine and the lessons that are being learned is key if we are to retain an advantage. And there are German companies working on this. There are others working on this. But as we know, the German Titan vendor has been certainly slow to embrace the new. It's the main spending on defense is on an old shopping list already from the mid-2010s. It's not necessarily on the new kind of shaping technologies that we would need to maintain an edge. And Aaron, that does rather raise the question of what's expected of allies in this regard, doesn't it?
Well, absolutely. And we've spoken before about the gulf that exists between the US and Europe on even de-risking from China, how exactly, more American voices are in favor of sort of a full decoupling or towards a full decoupling, we should say, simply because what that dependence could do to us as the West, should the Chinese actually take steps to invade Taiwan for potentially the reason of taking control of something like a chip supply chain. That is a new incentive that goes on top of its territorial claim, as we were discussing at the beginning of the show. But if the rubber does really meet the road on this, if an American warship is sunk by the Chinese in the Taiwan Strait, if China starts making moves to actually invade Taiwan, what do you think the U.S.'s actual expectations of Europe would be?
I think one of the challenges of thinking through severe crises and shocks like this is that it's very difficult to predict how people's mental maps of what is possible changes. And I think if you'd asked almost any European leader on February 20th, 2022, what their plausible responses would be to a full-scale Russia-Ukraine war, I don't think any of them would have predicted the types of steps they were willing to take 2 weeks later. And I think China-Taiwan dynamics have the same really fundamental uncertainties involved. I think there are people in Europe who think it might be possible for Europe to sort of stand aside in a case of a crisis like that. In my view, that would be impossible for political reasons, for economic reasons, for military reasons. Any sort of war between China and the United States would draw in basically every region of the world, if they liked it or not. And I think as a result of that, it's in Europe's interest to start thinking seriously about how Europe would manage, because neutrality would be impossible in a context in which economic supply chains were completely disrupted, in which there was a war that would be fought not just in one theater, but probably in multiple geographic theaters, and in which Europe would find itself damaged, even if it was not directly participating, in a way that would push it towards participation. And so I think all that suggests that Europe does need to start thinking about this issue very carefully. And to think that you can just stand aside, I think misreads both the scope of disruption purely in economic terms that Europe would face, but also the extent that the US and China would both be pushing extraordinarily heavily on Europe to take steps. And Europe couldn't simply do nothing.
You've spoken just now, made it an excellent point, I think. Suddenly, what was inconceivable for is now a very real. But the drawback of acting that way is, again, you act reactively, not proactively in any kind of strategic sense. And right now, evidence from Europe indicates that we are extremely unprepared for what might happen if tensions with China over Taiwan or anything else were to increase. So what kind of steps do you think are necessary to start considering then, so that we're not consistently caught on the back foot all the time should something like this happen?
I think that the first is for European political leaders and also business leaders to start doing their own scenarios. What would happen if? In the US, there's been a real mental shift over the past couple of years as both government think tanks and companies have started doing scenarios of crises in the Taiwan Straits. And that has sensitized, I think, a lot of people to just how dramatic the costs could be and just how far-reaching the impact would be. And there certainly are people in Europe thinking through these issues, but my sense is that the number of European political leaders who have participated in a Taiwan Straits war game is substantially lower than the number of American or Japanese leaders who have done so. And once you start participating and thinking through the second and third order conflicts, you begin to realize that this issue ought to be higher up on your priority list, because the magnitude of impact it would have on you is quite large. I think the second issue is that there are a lot of people, especially in the business world, but I think also, at least in certain countries in political and policy debates as well, who think that the risk of a crisis involving China, whether Taiwan-focused, Philippines-focused, India-focused, is approximately zero. In their mental models, they assign a 0% probability, and they don't have to think about it. And I don't know what the probability is, but it's not zero. And so once you start thinking about the probability being 5% or 10%, suddenly the magnitude is so large, you've got to start incorporating the expected value into all of your calculations. And that, I think, is a second really important conclusion from participating in these war games. It doesn't take a sort of bolt from the blue or a real political surprise to reach a crisis. You can just follow forward current political dynamics between China and the Philippines, where there are Chinese maritime militia and naval ships daily facing off against Filipino ships over disputed underwater island formations, shooting each other with water cannons. It's not hard to imagine how that could spiral in a very dangerous direction very quickly.
I'd take your point a step further, actually, and say they assign a zero possibility because they don't want to think about what the potential outcome of a non-zero possibility would be of that happening, because they don't want the answer. This is also why not to participate in the war game or thinking it through, because that would require a level of change that they're not willing to deliver. And I think in Germany, that goes for the chancellery. And there's a serious question in Germany. Are we seeing a divergence between those multinational companies, notionally German still, who are banking on being too big and too German to be allowed to fail should this go, should the balloon go up in the Taiwan Strait, and Germany's people? Is that a dynamic that you see in other places as well? I mean, obviously, this is a contested field.
No, I think that that is present in basically all of the G7 economies. You've got a smaller number of companies in basically every country that are making up a larger share of foreign direct investment into China. I mean, in Europe, the numbers are really quite shocking, how around half of FDI is produced by just 10 or so companies. And those companies, when they invest in China, the aim is to have future corporate profits coming from China. Those corporate profits accrue to the shareholders, who are often international rather than German in the case of German companies, or French in the case of French companies. And it does bring substantial risk that their investments could go to zero, just like their Russia investments did. Now, again, if you apply your 0% probability, you end up with some value on those investments. But if you apply a 10% probability or a 20% probability, your scenario planning would look quite different. And that's why I think, in addition to both governments and the policy community more generally, putting a bit of pressure on companies to take risks seriously, to actually properly price risks, I think there is also a role for regulation and legislation in inducing companies to undertake similar types of risk assessments and scenario planning. And I do worry that there are some countries and some industries where CEOs have gotten away for too long with pricing risks at zeros, and thereby taking, I think, irresponsible steps that, as you suggest, do eventually leave taxpayers potentially on the hook for bailing them out.
Indeed, the pursuit of that private profit ends up with an externalized social risk for which we are exposed to, which are those who could deal with it and are not doing. And what we know from Germany is the China strategy in particular leaves all this very deliberately up to companies. And a lot of those companies are saying, thanks very much, zero possibility, off we go, as we were before. But there is investment in other ways as well. We see investment coming, for example, from TSMC into Germany. And we also see chip manufacturing in Europe being given a boost. Is your feeling that we're on the right track there, or are we still in the business of picking winners in a rather unstrategic way?
I think I do see the evidence of increased cross-border chip industry investments as a very positive sign. I think first, it's a reminder that although it's true there's a number of Western businesses that invest a lot in China, Western countries invest a lot more in each other. And there's really no comparison. The amount of European FDI into the US or US FDI into Europe is substantially above either region's FDI into China. And that's I think, critically important to keep in mind. I also think that I occasionally hear people talk about deglobalization. And in the chip industry, I see no evidence of that. I see US firms investing in Ireland and Germany, in Israel. I see Japanese firms investing more in Taiwan. I see Taiwanese firms investing in Japan and the US and Germany. And so deglobalization does not remotely describe what we're seeing right now. I think we are seeing a deliberate effort to reduce reliance on China, that's for sure. But I think rightly so, both businesses and governments have tried to make this not about self-sufficiency, not about deglobalization. And we're beginning to see, in at least certain segments, creation of a political bloc that maps onto an economic bloc. And to me, that's a world that seems much less risky than the one we currently live in.
Right, absolutely. It's that rethinking of what do we mean by the globe and globalization and who's part of that or not that I think is one of the key geopolitical and geoeconomic acts of this time. One thing that struck me in the book was not only was I actually able to now finally understand what a silicon chip is, what a semiconductor is composed of. So you managed to make the technology understandable, but also you managed to humanize it. And you did so through talking through the stories of the players involved. And there really were some characters involved in this, in the business of creating semiconductors and inventing them in the first place, as well as then in marketing them. Could you talk us through some of your favorite characters you came across in this book? And I'm thinking of people like Bob Norris, Andy Grove, Pat Haggerty, Morris Chang.
Morris Chang is the person who is most underestimated in terms of his importance and who illustrates in a lot of ways the development of the chip industry. He's born in mainland China before the revolution, fled when the communists took power in 49, enrolled at Harvard, then MIT, and was really present at the creation of the chip industry, worked for Texas Instruments for many decades, held a top secret U.S. security clearance for his work on defense electronics, and then moved to Taiwan in 1987 to found TSMC and helped it grow to become the world's largest chip maker. And so, you know, I think his life illustrates, on the one hand, the really deep connections between the chip industry and East Asia that were present from the beginning, represents the globalized nature of the chip industry, and also represents, I think, some of the challenges that the West faces in trying to navigate its reliance on TSMC and Taiwan. Because there are people like him who are not replaceable. They have human capital and expertise and networks that make it very difficult to imagine shifting the geographic footprint of the chip industry in a short period of time. And that's really critical to remember. Chips are built by machines and by factories, but they're all ultimately built by people. And where those people live and where their networks exist is just as important as any decision about investment policy in terms of shaping the industry.
Right. And indeed, also where those people got their habitus, where they got their founding qualities of their own lives. They're situated folk in particular places, of course. And Chang's background as an immigrant into the US and then a migrant into Taiwan again, a bit of a Steve Jobs figure in some ways, that he retired from the business, then had to come back to save it, drag it back up to his value base. But there was also another migrant, Andy Grove, Andras Grof, who had a fascinating story. Perhaps you tell us a little bit about him.
He was born in Budapest, fled after the communists took power as well, arrived penniless in New York in the mid-50s, got a degree in engineering and started working at Intel right when it was being founded in the late 1960s, and ended up becoming the CEO of Intel throughout the 1980s, and made it at the time the world's largest and most successful chip firm. And I think he illustrates, alongside Morris Chang, the extent to which the chip industry really has always drawn from an international talent pool. If you look at the founders of key chip companies in the US, for example, or in Asia, if you look at the key innovators behind technological improvements, new transistor designs, new chemicals, a really surprising share are immigrants. And I think that's a dynamic that is very important to keep in mind today as governments tighten up rules over talent flows, for example. They need to make sure they don't tighten them too far and limit the ability to attract talent that still remains, I think, key to retaining on top technologically.
That's it. We're in a competition for talent as well as a geopolitical competition, and the two are highly connected. So to leverage the advantage of our free societies, we actually have to let freedom breathe. But tell me one more thing. Where are the women in this story?
Well, I think the chip industry deserves a fair amount of criticism for the fact that it has been extraordinarily male-dominated. Now, actually, women have played a very large role in chip production processes, but largely in the assembly and the test portions. If you look at the factories that were assembling chips in the early decades of the chip industry, it was largely women on the assembly lines, but it was not largely women in the design process or in the leadership positions. And even today, I think the chip industry is, I would give it low marks compared to most other industries in terms of women in the executive positions or prominent female leaders. I think Lisa Su of AMD, current CEO, is one very important exception. But I think the chip industry has a long way to go when it comes to achieving gender equality goals.
Again, another key element of leveraging our advantage. Just to round that out, what I found particularly admirable, or one of the many things I found admirable about Chris Miller's book, Chip War, is the way that he follows and traces the story of those characters as a way of tracing technological development, geopolitical competition, the economic ups and downs of particular firms, but also countries involved. And this process of rebuilding Intel that Andy Grove undertook, which detailed in his famous book called Only the Paranoid Will Survive, great book title. This is a recurring cycle, of course, in business. And we have to be able to take the stories from that, take the lessons from that forward. But keeping sight of the people involved, I think, is something that Chris does particularly well for someone who's operating at that level of geopolitical and geoeconomic sophistication. One small example, close to the beginning of the book, we're introduced to a person called Jay Lathrop, who actually invented the lithography techniques that are now absolutely crucial to producing silicon chips, to producing the semiconductors that are in all of our technology. It was recognized at the time this was such a breakthrough that he was still actually working for the Army before he went to go and take a corporate job. And the Army paid him $25,000 in cash for this discovery. And that was back in the late 50s. And this is a technological breakthrough that changed the world as we know it. At the very end of the book, Chris comes back into this story of Jay Lathrop, talking about moving his family to Texas, to Austin, to work for Texas Instruments. And we're told they were still in the old car. They hadn't actually bought the new station wagon, which that $25,000 would eventually give to the family. So it's picking up all the way through those developments that are personal, as well as economic, political, and technological and scientific. So highly recommend to read Chris Miller's book, Chip War. And we'll be following up on some of those themes in the remainder of this season of Berlin Inside Out and in our future endeavors.
Absolutely. Thanks so much to Chris Miller, author of Chip War, for joining us. And one thing that is very clear in both the book and also our chat with him today is that's why he calls it Chip War, the systemic competition element that is at work here. And we heard a lot in this particular episode about how that's relevant when we consider China and the threat that China poses to Taiwan in particular, but also to the security of really the globe and our own Western societies in its own various ways. But there's another element to this as well. It's not simply the threat that China poses. There's a little bit of an indirect thing that we can follow here when it comes to the systemic competition elements of chips. And that is that there is actually a Russian element to this as well. The Russian military is getting access to Western chips, usually actually by buying them from China. And those chips are obviously being used to wage war against Ukraine. And that is obviously has huge implications for our own security. So when we think about this chip war, there's other theaters that it pops up, not simply in East Asia, of course. So when we're talking about going for victory in a place like Ukraine. Another thing that we really need to consider, I would say, is the tightening of sanctions and export controls on these chips. How are these Western chips that are in China going to Russia and directly affecting the war in Ukraine and our own European security?
We have to be conscious of this in all aspects because we've seen the use that chips can be put to, be that re-equipping dumb bombs to make them into smart bombs, guided bombs, which the Russians have been using, even taking things, chips from washing machines or so on. So we really have to have a global view of this to make sure that we are restricting Russia's capability to wage war and certainly stopping its capability to win war on all the fronts where it exists.
That's why we have to consider chip war in a full global context. That's all for this episode of Berlin Side Out. Thank you very much to our guest today, Chris Miller, for joining us. You can find information on his book, Chip War, in our show notes. Thank you also to our project assistant, Julian Stuckle, our technical producer, Hendrik Vanna, and the DJP team. Join us over the next few weeks. We head to Tallinn for the Leonard Mary Conference and bring you the talk of the town straight from there, as well as our upcoming episodes on what's needed for Ukrainian victory, the pillars of victory, if you will, and the role Russia's nuclear blackmail is playing into current German and Western strategic choices. For now, though, from Berlin, auf Wiedersehen and tschüss.